everyone, and welcome to Minute 41 of Season 7 of Movie Rob Minute, the daily podcast where we yippee-ki-yay our way through the 1995 Bruce Willis action film Die Hard with a Vengeance, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me today is Niall McGowan of the Bat Minute. Welcome back to the show, Niall.
Hello, Rob. I'm very happy to be here. That was, in fact, my best Jeremy Irons in this movie. if it didn't land with people, then we're in a lot of trouble already, I think.
Well, yeah, I think he did better with Jimmy Stewart last season, but you know, that's fine. I can't do any impressions, so you know, you're one step ahead of me. Even bad impressions are better than my attempt at impressions. So, but no, I wasn't sure if you were trying to do a German Simon or a British Simon. That's the thing I couldn't get with your impression, but like I said, better than mine. So I give you credit for trying.
See, I've tried Jeremy Irons several times, and every time people are just like, what's that supposed to be? So I think maybe I'm the problem could I be a bad impersonator? No, it's the children who are wrong.
Yeah, of course, but you know, you do have. Not necessarily in your Batman realm, but Jeremy Irons is connected to the Batman realm, so you have that too.
Yeah, he's one of the best elements of those films too. Jeremy Irons, like him and Affleck as a duo, were phenomenal in those films. So it was just like that was really like I would happily watch a film of just them hanging out in the Batcave. So
Alfred. Who do you think is the best Alfred then?
I always have to go for Michael Goff by default, because that's the Alfred I grew up with, and that's the one we spent the most time with. And like in my mind, whenever I think of Alfred, it always is Michael Goff. So he is my gut reaction. But like Jeremy Irons, he really very quickly carved out a niche as that part, though. Like literally the second he showed up in the film, it was just like, ooh, okay. Right about this guy. Like when they announced his casting, I was a bit like, English, I guess, you know, fine. And then like, yeah, it came in, but he's so much snark. It is the Irons Alfred. Like, it's kind of hard to imagine him being, the compassionate father figure he needs to be at times, because he just his version of the character does nothing but give like Bruce Wayne a hard time, basically, which is deserved. But also, you're about like, oh, but yeah, we never got to see the other side of him. But I'd like to think that Irons could play that as well, quite frankly.
Right. Okay, that's true. I mean, I've always been a fan of Alan Napier as Alfred. You know, again, I think it goes according to what you just said. You know, you grew up with Michael Goh being Alfred. You know, before I saw all of the, you know, before the 1989 Batman came out, so I had seen, you know, as a kid, the TV show The Batman. So that. It goes according to the same thing, you know.
Yeah. And then this is like, you know, but then, during my teen years, my 20s, then it was all Michael Caine. But then I always have trouble with his Alfred because he's great in the films, but it's just like, he's just Michael Caine. Like, he's just showing up doing, it's just as if he just wandered on set and was just like, all right, I'll just say these lines in my usual way. And then.
You see, there, you did a great impression. There you go. Don't knock yourself there.
I'm sure for many people, he Michael Caine is the definitive Alfred, but for me, it'll always be Goff. And again, it's one of those things, he's in about 5 million other films too, so you always get that little thrill of every time you're watching an old Hammer horror film or something, and then you get like, a young Alfred popping up, and you're like, there he is.
That's true. I mean, one of my problems with Michael Caine as Alfred is that they make him into this butler who used to be a mercenary. And it's like, okay, how does that work? You know, it's like, I can sort of understand, you know, maybe, you know, we didn't get the life debt story, you know, where Bruce Wayne's father saved Alfred, and therefore he has his life debt to him and decided that he's going to give up being a mercenary and he's going to spend the rest of his life as the butler.
The zero year and stuff, I think, did variations on that, but they just keep making Alfred tougher and tougher and tougher. So like they have that Beware the Batman cartoon, which is the same exact principle of just like it was basically a life debt scenario. But like the oh, Alfred wow. in that is basically like Jason Statham. Like they're like, oh, so he was a soldier, right? So let's make him the toughest piece of crap that ever existed and stuff. It kind of gets drifted so far away now from like the even the Andy Serkis one has that vibe too, because he's such a rough and tumble kind of the way he plays it. He really feels like, yeah, I am like whatever bizarre rich people rationale happened there. Like I was in the army or whatever with your dad, and now, like,
and I'm your butler.
Yeah, and it was just like, so now I became like not so much a family friend as an indentured servant, and I have to go around dressed in a tuxedo every day. And even though they've been dead for 20 years, I'm still on the show up and like, you know, dust your goddamn vases for you and stuff. It's like
that's right.
It kind of makes sense on paper, but then if we actually get into the whole thing, like it's Because Michael Caine version never specifies exactly, I'll be looking forward to those seasons because we'll be able to make up our own rationale for why the hell he's there.
But, right. I mean, he's basically the Chewbacca of the Batman series again.
It kind of feels like maybe he was like back in the day he was in Alfie mode, where like Alfred came in and like seduced Martha Wayne or something, and then Thomas is like, I can never forgive you, Alfred. I can't believe it. It's like I'll do anything for your forgiveness, Thomas. I was like, well, all right, well, I do need a new butler. That seems a bit awkward, but okay, I guess we can do that.
It could also be that Alfred is actually Bruce Wayne's real father.
It could be.
So he wanted to find a way to still stay, you know, in touch with his son. Mm-hmm. So, but then that doesn't explain the 20-year, why he never revealed his true identity.
Mm. And then probably just thought it'd be more like, I don't know if that'd be like better or worse for Bruce if he was just like, don't worry, Master Wayne, your father's not dead because your father is me. it's like the thing with. It must be. You just have to let him get through, you know, the initial layers of psychological trauma before you get into the whole. Like, by the way, your family wasn't even your family. Like,
that's right. And Alfred was the one who hired, Jack Napier to kill him off.
Yeah,
there you go. It can get really twisted.
The thing is, though, I can't imagine Michael Caine getting involved in any conspiracies because he would be like. If anyone else, like, well, so who's the guy who hired you? He's like, well, he was an English guy, and he had a weird way of talking like this. And then everyone would instantly be like, oh, I know that. That's Bruce Wayne's butler. Like, no one else thought that. It'd be like Chris Walken being involved in a conspiracy. Like, everyone would just know straight away. It's like, oh, he had a weird speaking voice. He kind of talked like this, and then would go into this. And then everyone's like, oh, no, I know that guy. We know who he is. We can go pick up that guy right now.
Yeah. Interesting. All right, so let's actually start talking a little bit about Die Hard. Yes. Not that wasn't fun. That was fun. I love it.
If you're gonna bring up Alfred to me, you know you're gonna get a tangent, Rob. Like it's gonna.
I knew it. I wasn't. You didn't shock me by it. You know, it's fine. It's fine. So minute 41 begins with Zeus giving an answer and ends with John. Trying to understand cross-examination. So we ended things on Friday with John turning to both Lambert and Zeus and saying, what were the chances that we're going to get here in time? Mm. You know, and we had a great cliffhanger waiting till today to have to you know, continue with that line of thought.
Yeah.
So This minute begins with Zeus for saying Zip. You know. So what is Zip?
Well, I know like the term Zip obviously means, you know, it's commonly paired with nada, you know, bupkis, things like that. I don't know the etymology though. Have you looked into like why people refer to it as Zip?
Of course I have.
Oh, here we go.
So, I mean, a zip, first of all, is, as you said, it's zero. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a slang term for the number zero, which zero is the number that we all know about. It's an empty quantity. Mm-hmm. You know, so when you add a zero to any number, it doesn't change anything. And but it when you can use it with decimals and stuff like that, when you're trying to break down a number and stuff like that. Some different names for it are for names for the number zero are, or the number, yeah, the number zero. You have naught, nil, and naught. You also have zilch, zip, and some people even use the word cipher.
Cipher. Oh, no, I've never heard that one.
Yeah, I'd never heard that one either. It really that one really jumped out at me.
Did the
That
space
it's
just
very
specify
interesting that you're calling it a
like which
cipher.
country uses that though? Because that just seems like I've never heard that like ever.
No, it's saying that historically it was either known as aught, O-U-G-H-T, A-U-G-H-T, and cipher.
Wow. Well, maybe we
That's
should
all it
bring it
doesn't say.
back. Just every time
Yeah.
now you have to mention zero. Just throw in cipher and just see how it settles with people.
That's
Maybe
right.
people might be like, "What the hell are you talking about?" Or they might be like, "Oh, that's cool. I'm gonna do that now too." And then the ripples happen, and throughout the world, all of a sudden, everyone's referring to zero as cipher again. That's all. And people like it.
That's right. What when do you think people started using the word
Was it in the
zero?
year zero?
In English,
The
in
first
English.
year where people had language and they're like, what year is it? And they went zero. Like, let's just go with
No, it was they first started referring to the number as zero in 1598. It comes from the there's a French word that's very similar called zero, and that came from the Italian word, which was a contraction of the Venetian word safira. There's a term in Arabic called sifr,
Wow. Okay.
which means empty, which maybe could that might be the
Ah.
connection to cipher, because you have SIFR, and so there was just an empty. I guess they refer to things just as like
Yeah. Yeah.
aught or stuff like that.
But it's not though. Zip. Where's that? Like, if I had to guess, I was just like, well, is it something to do with like the zipper on a body bag? Because once you're dead, you're nothing. So you're zip pulling up the zipper of the bag.
Well, it actually is connected also to the fact that originally Fibonacci, who was an Italian mathematician, so he was the one who introduced the decimal system to Europe, and he used the term zephyrum, which eventually became zephyro, and that was changed to zero. And basically, when you usually when you read out a group of numbers, how would you refer to the number zero?
But I've called zero, like, or yeah.
If you're telling someone a phone number, you would say your phone
But
number is 044, or you would
yep,
say
I would say zero.
something
Like my
else.
dad would say, my
Okay,
dad would
most
say
people.
oh. It was,
That's right. That's what I was looking for. The idea is that most people use the term O for it. So like if you have an area code of 201, so you would say 201. And then in the year 1907, you would say 1907, or 2007,
Yeah,
and that
I
type of
always
thing.
use the word zero when I have the chance though, because it sounds cool. It's one of those things that because the Z is one of the lesser used letters, so it's always fun when it gets brought up into things. And so when I have the opportunity to say zero, of course I'm not gonna miss that chance. Like, so yeah, every time I give out a phone number, it's
That's
always
true. Have...
079 and all of the things like that.
Okay, makes sense. And there's a sports terminology for the term zero also. People use they call
Oh
it a goose egg.
I'm assuming it's because like it was a goose egg, it's just like perfectly round, so it looks like a zero. Is that the idea? Yeah.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I think they're oval, aren't they? I mean, I know that chicken eggs are oval. I don't think I've ever had a goose egg.
And then the term nil is so if you're of a certain generation over here,
Yes.
it's tied to a lot of very boring memories of childhood where you'd be sitting around the house on a rainy Saturday afternoon and your dad would be watching the football scores which is, you know, back then pre-internet, all that kind of thing. You just had to wait to hear the scores of all these things in one big chunk on the Saturday afternoon. And so you just get a guy for ages with like a really dreary voice going, like Crystal Palace 1, Portic Thistle 0, Range Rovers 7, Portic Thistle 0. You just hear that like for like about 25 straight minutes, just sonorously booming from the TV. And you're like, oh my God, why, how could the weekend be this bad? Why am I stuck inside with a stupid goddamn score?
I always love listening to, you know, football scores or soccer scores. I'm not a sports fan, you know, where they say it's, you know, nil or nil nil,
yeah.
Tied at nil. You know, it's like, yeah, you can't. Yeah. You have to have someone win.
And then, of course, over here we have the Eurovision. And there's always the thrill. It's always a little bit of joy in Ireland because, yeah, new
one.
Just like, but every time, like, because there was a couple of years there where that's all that England was ever getting. Like, literally 7 years in a row or something. It was like every single country would just come back with England, new one. But then the Irishman in me was a bit like, yes, yes.
Right. I mean, back in the 80s, the England and Ireland did well.
Yeah.
Better than the. It's because you guys just don't dress up, crazy.
Ireland's made some big attempts recently to be like, oh, we're going as crazy as possible. But like, no, you never know what's going to land over in the continent. They're testy people over there.
Yeah, it's true. You need a strong consensus over all of England. Or Europe, sorry.
Yeah, yeah.
Not just England. The term zip is basically, it's a very strange way for it to be used here because it means that, you know, someone who is enthusiastic or energetic about something. So I guess in one way you can say that Zeus was, you know, emphatic by saying, yeah, nothing. There's no chance. I wasn't able to find when and where the people started using zip as the as a term for zero, because again, it's something that is relatively new. I guess you can say
it was something to do with like zip codes, and like in America, like maybe they all began with zero at one point, and everyone would just go like zip 152, like the beginning of something like that.
Well, a zip code, I'm pretty sure a zip code, if I remember correctly, it zip stands for something. It's not, it does. It's zone improvement plan.
Oh, wow! I had no idea.
Yeah. We talked about this. I don't think it was last season. It must have. I don't remember which season we talked about it. We talked about zip codes at some point.
Yeah. It's just weird because over here we have like postcodes, so I assumed I thought it was a postal thing, but zone improvement plan is it sounds completely different.
Yeah. Yeah, they started that in the 60s for the whole thing.
Oh, wow. Well, yeah, but that's my theory out the door then, I guess.
Sorry. Yeah, but, you know, the idea is that, you know, if you have the term zip, so, you know, it's like you see that actually go back to the Batman TV show from the 60s. You know, they would say they would have zip on screen, you know, if something was like flying by or really quickly, like a bullet or something like that, you know. Mm-hmm.
They may be Zeus is verbally assaulting McClane then by going zip instead of throwing a punch. It's like, oh, you just say the sound effect. It has the same effect afterwards.
That's true. Sure. I could see Samuel L. Jackson doing that.
Samuel L. Jackson, although he's so deeply entrenched in Marvel, it's just like I don't know if he would ever turn and go to DC for anything. I don't know if they could win him over, but I would love to see Batman up against Samuel L. Jackson at some point.
Against? I don't. Oh, you mean you want to see him as a?
Oh yeah, it's like I'm telling you, Samuel L. Jackson as Egghead, or just but you get him in there, and I don't know if they'll bring him in. He doesn't. I don't know if he has the vibe for like the Matt Reeves Batman movies, but like James Gunn, maybe he could do something. Bring Sam in as a, you know, I was going to say Polka Dot Man, but they already did Polka Dot Man. So,
well, not in live action. So
Oh, they did. They did. David Dismulgen played him in the Suicide Squad with James Gunn. So, yeah.
No. Oh, right. But sorry, you're right. I was I got that confused for a second. You're right. I was, for some reason, I was thinking that was in the Spider-Verse. I don't know why.
I think it's in the Spider-Verse, and they have the Spot. It was just kind of similar design and stuff. Like, oh, he's covered in spots.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's why I got those confused. You're right. Yes, the Polka Dot Man was in Suicide Squad. Yes, which I actually just saw like last month again.
Oh,
yeah. I should have known that.
Yeah, we're waiting to we want to do on our on the Batman and Patreon feed. We're hoping to be able to get into reviewing each episode of Peacemaker, but we're just waiting for season 2. Which, because I know they just started filming, so I was like, we're going to be waiting a while, I guess. But I'm so every time I was like, oh, the Suicide, I'll go back to the Suicide Squad.
Then season 2 will finish, and then you'll say, oh, we're going to wait for season 3 to end.
No, I think we'll hopefully definitely intercept them when season 2, when it inevitably shows up. Next year, maybe. Okay. That's what God only knows, but I'm sure we'll get there. We'll get there, Bob.
Yeah. So the use of Zip as the as Zero was first recorded around the turn of the century, around 1900, and it was just a from what I was able to find, it's just because it starts with a Z or a Z, as you said. Mm. They just used, you have Zero, Zilch, Zip. Mm. They all go together very easily.
Yeah, yeah.
I guess so. Who knows?
But then, if you were to use Cypher, would you want to put a Z on it? Then would you go? You'd say Cypher, but you'd spell it with a Z in front, just for the.
That's an interesting. It's an interesting idea, but again, if this was only an Americanism from the beginning of the 20th century, then Cypher, as we said, goes back very, very far. Mm. It goes back hundreds, if not thousands, of years. Mm. So. That wouldn't necessarily fit in. I mean, if you want to fit that in afterwards, it's like pushing something into a certain area after the fact. Mm-hmm. Even though that was the first, I don't know, or among the first, however you want to look at it.
For so long, though, it's just lying in wait. It'll be back. It'll definitely come back. You don't exist for that long without some sort of, without some sort of ripple effect. Like something, it'll come back in a wave eventually. The kids on TikTok will start saying Cypher for Zero. I know it. I feel it in my blood.
There's also a phrase called zip tone. Have you ever heard of that?
No.
A zip tone is also known as a whisper tone or a call waiting tone. It's the tone that when you're in the middle of a conversation and you hear like the beeping sound of someone else trying to call. Uh-huh. So that is known as a zip tone. The difference between a ringtone and a zip tone, and there's a ringtone is when the line is not engaged, and a zip tone is something you hear when the line is already engaged.
So, one of those things you just like, oh, I wouldn't have thought that anyone had actually thought up a term for that. In terms of, no, people have got it covered. Someone out there was just like, no, I'm calling it this. And then if you go to the manual, go to your manual on English language. And you'll discover whenever you need to refer to what that is, but no one's going to know what to refer to it as. You're just going to be like, oh, the beeping when someone's engaged. It's like, no, we have a term for it. Someone went out of their way to make a term for that.
Yeah, but that's what they do. There are people who that's their job.
Yeah.
I remember in the 80s. I don't know if this ever came to England. There was a TV show on HBO called Not Necessarily the News. And one of the segments that they would have was called Sniglets by Rich Hall.
Huh?
Pretty sure it was Rich Hall. And basically the idea was he would every week or every episode, he would introduce a few words that are completely crazy. Like what do you call the cold spot on a pillow that you turn it over at night in order to find the cold spot? Like things like that.
Yeah.
And I never knew if these are real words or not. Like,
well, what's it called?
Yeah, I don't remember. That's
I'll look it up for next episode.
Come on, you're asking me. You're asking me to remember from 50 years ago to 40 years ago to remember the name of. Right. Okay. So here, so I did get it right. It was Rich Hall. He conceived the term Sniglet when he was on Not Necessarily the News. And they had a monthly episode. It had a regular segment of Snigglets, which Hall described as any word that doesn't appear in the dictionary but should. And he actually then published a book called Snigglets, which had a list of all the different things. All right, here. Here. What is the term aquedexterous mean?
Does it mean that you're really good underwater? That you're able to use your hands underwater, maybe?
Very close. If you're able to turn the bathtub faucet with your toes.
I'm liking the idea of these Snigglets. I think that might be the rest of my afternoon after we're done. Let's just go into.
There you go. There's a cast Cape Caspers. I like that one. This one I like. It's the cast Caspers are dead actors who appear on TV.
Sadly, I think that we might have a couple of cast Caspers later in this week when we get into the van and stuff. Yeah.
Yes. I don't. They don't have the one that I mentioned here. What's a Persibus?
I don't think I could even guess that.
Where unrecovered belongings reside within a woman's handbag.
He's good at that ritual. Like, I always knew I liked that guy. I think, too, because he has such a distinct face. So I'm imagining, like, even though it's you saying it, I'm imagining him delivering it, you know?
That's okay. It's perfectly okay. I don't take offense by that. I mean, looking at a picture of him now, he looks very different, you know, than he did back then. But, you know, that's because he's now 70. And back then he was in his, you know, he was 30.
Yeah.
Slightly different.
Yeah. But, well, speaking of like little,
right.
one of my favorite things in this minute is, but not this lady comes over and says like, Lieutenant, McLean's sort of acknowledgement of her with this sort of like, like this sort of like, yeah, but also just like, letting out all his frustrations of just like, okay, I'm in the middle of something and then something else has now happened. And he just has that kind of like, what is it? You know, a polite, what is it now? Almost kind of vibe to it. Yeah.
But before we get to the lady, there's a few things that happened. So they continue this conversation. And then John says that bomb was going to go off no matter what. He wanted to go off right down here. And then he turns to the guy next to him who we don't see. And he goes, take this off me, Dave. I'm assuming that he's just referring to like a bandage or something like that. And then Lambert says, what's so special about this place? And he goes, I don't know. Something just doesn't add up. And then the woman comes in and, you know, I couldn't find out who she is because on IMDb, I couldn't find someone who fits her.
Yeah.
I guess description.
Would you be like thick Bronx cop maybe or something like.
That's right. Yeah. She has a very, very thick accent. Lieutenant McLean. He goes, huh? They're asking for you and Mr. Cobb.
I'm wondering if that was her actual accent or if she's just like, oh, well, if I get a line, then I'm going to zhuzh it up a little. You know? And came in with a big, like she's like, oh, okay, so I can do this voice if you want over here. Like, yeah, sure. Yeah, you do
That's
that.
Right. Yeah, no, we've had a lot of problems over the last, 40 episodes where there are characters who you just can't find out who they are, even though they probably are listed somewhere on IMDb, but just the way that they're described just doesn't work.
There was someone, I did find them eventually, but there's like a fairly prominent speaking character in the next couple of minutes that I couldn't find on IMDb. Well, I had to go through the Die Hard wiki to get to this guy. It's like, geez, Louise, I thought like this thing would have been more, thoroughly curated over there. It's such a big film.
Well, we'll get there and let's see what let's say we both found the same responses to that when we get there.
Yeah.
Who knows? And then, you know, John is brought to a van and he's, you know, goes into the van. There's a lot of commotion around and stuff like that. Both Connie and Walsh are, they show us this, like blonde Secret Service guy outside who like gives him a quick look, you know, a suspicious look when they're about to get into the van, and then they sit down next to Cobb, and then Cobb says, John, this is Andy Cross with the FBI.
Yeah. I was going to say, too.
And then he goes, this is Mr. Jarvis. He's and then Jarvis goes, I'm with another agency.
It's that.
So do you know who these two actors are who play Cross and Jarvis?
Yeah, well, actually,
any clue?
In my mind is like, oh yeah, that'll be like in an episode, you know, in the next episode. But no, Jarvis. He was a guy like, yeah, Bill Jarvis. I thought like, oh, that's gonna pop out on IMDb. Couldn't I did find him eventually, but couldn't find him just on the list. Maybe you had better luck.
He's on the list in IMDb under Jarvis, but I found some very interesting things about.
Oh yeah, I did. I looked into the guy, and it was a real like, you know, the opening lines of his Wikipedia were a real like, what? He did what? But yeah, very very accomplished that guy. Yeah.
Yeah, and not as an actor, but he's very accomplished in general. I mean, as an actor, he only has 31 IMDb credits. Most of them are very small parts. But he wrote the screenplay for The Witches of Eastwick, for The Bonfire of the Vanities, for Mr. Jones, for Gia. He is an award-winning playwright. Hmm. He won a Tony for the Pulitzer Prize for a play that he wrote called The Shadow Box.
That was what really got me. It was like, oh, Pulitzer Prize winning writer. It's like, what the hell? I was like, what's he doing?
And he also won a DGA award for Gia as, you know, best TV director or something. Yeah, best TV movie director. And yeah. Like, I was shocked about that too.
I've only seen Gia in recent years. It was one of my friends was like really obsessed. Like, it was one of the random things you get. People who are randomly obsessed with very weird, obscure things. And yeah, Gia, the TV movie starring Angelina Jolie, is like one of my friend's favorite films. She just talks about it all the time. I was like, what the hell is Gia?
I've never seen it. Is it worth watching?
But, it's late 90s HBO, so you're in like that's when HBO is really kicking off. So like, yeah, it does have a distinct smattering of quality about it. And like, yeah, early days Angelina Jolie, remembering why she got so acclaimed. I was like, oh, that's right, she was a really good actress back in the day.
Well, Michael Christopher won a DGA Best Director award for it, so he must have done a nice job.
Oh, those annoy too, because I tried to like, I found him through the Die Hard wiki, and then but they didn't have a like a hot link for him. And then I was annoyed because he spells Christopher slightly strangely. So I had to go over into a Google search engine and then have to like keep checking back to verify. Like, how's he spelling this? Just like, so it's Christopher, but it's like Christopher. And it's just,
that's right.
That makes things ever so slightly awkward, this guy.
Yeah. Well, he just wants to be different.
But yeah, obviously that'll be a big one in Lincoln. From my interest too, the Witches of Eastwick, because obviously has Jack Nicholson, but also produced by John Peters, who was that was their first time in bed together pre Batman. So yeah, and then of course then Michelle Pfeiffer too. So it's which we've never covered the Witches of Eastwick over on Batman. I think it's one we should really get to because it's got so much of a Batman 89, Batman Returns pedigree going on in there too. But
that's true. I actually years ago read the book.
Oh wow!
It was very
was good. It like a proper like it's dead serious or something. Like once you get these people together, once you get those performers together, it's a good.
I think it was. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, Michael Christopher has a small cameo in the first Exorcist film, and of course Samuel L. Jackson has a very bizarre cameo in the third Exorcist film. So it's like, that was a nice little bit of cross-pollination between these two guys literally sitting across from each other here.
There's always cross-pollination. You don't always have to go 6 degrees of separation when dealing with these type of things. 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon type of thing. Right.
Yeah. But then but Michael Christopher still, he was just in Fallout. He's like one of the elders in Fallout, it turns out, as well. So it's like, yeah, he's still popping, this guy.
It's true. And do you know who plays Andy Cross?
I do. I got not as accomplished, but I got some Charles Dumas.
That's right.
Fancy name. I went through his list. And I just know that he seemed to have like a good year or two in the 90s because he has this. And then his next credit is Copland, which is like, oh my god, like two like absolute solid masterpieces in a row, basically. And then like, yeah, the rest of his IMDb was a bit like, there's not much there. The thing that really popped out to me was that he's in Search Party, the Alia Shawkat TV show from a couple of years back, which is I really really loved Search Party. I was like, oh,
and no, do you remember no him from there? Or
no, no, no. I think he just, his credit is just like, you know, street cop or something like that. It might be that he didn't have all that prominent right. part.
See, for me, what stuck out was that he was in Deep Impact.
Oh,
yeah. Yes. He was one of the guys in the newsroom, you know, who was dealing with creating like a musical theme. And like, there's a point where he has to go on a helicopter and they tell him to get rid of his briefcase because it's too heavy, you know, that type of thing. But what I found really interesting is that he is now a professor of theater and film in Penn State University.
Oh, nice, nice. Oh, so he's doing well for himself then.
Apparently, yeah.
Yeah, he's no Pulitzer Prize winner, but, you know, he makes
no, sense. Well, he's next to the Pulitzer Prize winner, so it's okay. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
Should also say, too, that I discovered that that Pulitzer Prize winning play, the Shadow Box, apparently adapted into a film. Directed by Paul Newman.
That's right.
I think that's also a weird brag you could have. He was like, I wrote a play. I won the Pulitzer Prize. And then Paul Newman directed.
And it won a Tony. And then Paul Newman decided to make it into a made-for-TV movie and didn't win anything.
Yeah. I was like, well, that Paul Newman, he messed it up. You know, I think that was all his fault, really.
Probably. It's very.
If Robert Redford had directed it, well, I mean, come on, we would have been showering in awards. But
well, Redford was too busy at that point. You know, that was early 1980 when he himself was, winning his own awards for his directing.
That's why they probably like. It was like, oh, what's Redford got coming up? It was like, oh, he's got like Ordinary People or something. It's like, oh, I guess he's busy. Okay, Newman.
All right, well, we should have Newman.
you can direct it, I guess.
That's right. And then John basically, shakes their hands and says, "It's good to meet you." And then Cobb says, "This is Lieutenant McLean, and this is Mr. Carver." Hmm. You know, and what's really great is in the middle of this thing. Do you see what John does while they're talking to him? He like starts. He puts his finger in his ear. He's like rubbing his ear. Hmm. You know, obviously because, you know, he just had a massive explosion near his ear. But it's just very funny just the way that he does it. You know, and this seems to me like something that Bruce Willis just decided to do on the spot.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think it was in the script.
It's
to say, it's got, you know, John, start rubbing your ear.
Yeah. It's got the vibe of... When you're on an airplane, he's trying to get his ears to pop, basically. Like, he's kind of working his jaw as well. Like, he's really like, he's got a lot going on internally. Because, you know, again, literally a bomb just went off, like on him, basically. So,
correct.
He really, really should be, like, away getting tested and whatnot, like, more so than he already has been.
Correct. And then, so the conversation continues with them, and Cross starts giving, a little bit more information. He goes, we've got a couple of questions first. Hmm. He goes, do you recognize this guy? And they show them a picture, and we see a man and a woman in the picture standing in an airport. Hmm. You know, and then we see Jarvis in the background start to chew on his glasses.
Yeah. I think looking at these minutes in particular, knowing the line that's coming up in like minute five, he's chomping on those things.
That's right. That's right.
That's the whole scene. It's like, hey, it's totally his business, you know.
Correct.
Yeah, it's crazy how much he's actually sitting on those glasses, like throughout the whole damn thing.
Yeah, he really is. And he goes, no. And then he goes, how about this one? And they show him another picture of a guy in a German uniform, who we can recognize, obviously, is Simon, played by Jeremy Irons. And then they go, how about you? And then they show it to Zeus. Now, why would Zeus recognize any of these guys? Zeus is randomly in this whole thing.
I think
are they actually so suspicious that they think that Zeus might be in on this whole thing?
I get that. You just have to. That's how this agency operates. It's like you can leave no stone unturned. So like, I did think it was weird. because I know why Zeus is there in, like, you know, in the beginning, in that, like, how he got involved, and then, like, Simon being like, oh, now, you know, you're going to be part of this game. I did think it was weird in this scene where they're like, oh, bring him over too, because it is just like, he's just a grocery store owner, like, he's got nothing to do with this.
No, he's an electronic store.
But so it's just like a bit like, yeah, why are you now insisting that he has to be involved in everything? Cause like he actually has like no like proper business being here, but that would be, yeah, that would probably be it. It's like, we have to examine every possibility. So, you know, maybe he does know these people. He probably looked at the first one and was just like, oh yeah, that's Targo from Die Hard with a Vengeance. That guy, yeah, I'd recognize him anywhere.
Well, what's even funnier is that if they believe that Zeus is in on it, so he would tell them that he does recognize them?
It's like, oh, you got me. that's my old friend Targo, yeah. Like we go way back.
Right. So, yeah, it just doesn't make any sense to me, the way that they do that there. You know, I don't know. I guess maybe they just want Zeus to feel as if he's important.
No, I think it genuinely would be, though. Just like a kind of...
Or to show the incompetence of these federal agents. They... You know, that... I mean, which we'll get to later in the week. There's a lot to talk about the incompetence.
Across the Jarvis, don't come across. There's the guy in the back. He's taking the FBI lessons in decorum. He knows how to handle himself.
All right. Well, we'll get there. We'll get there to him, too. And then then Cross asks him, did you recognize the voice on the phone? And then John looks at him and goes, no.
I can't do this all stuff. You'd be like, if I recognized the voice on the phone, don't you think I would have done something about it? Like if I was like, oh.
Yeah. Wouldn't I have already told you that before?
I pick up the phone and it's like, oh, that sounds like my friend Ron. Like I'm going to be like, I think it's him. I'm not going to be just like, well, I didn't want to say anything, you know, because it was inconvenient.
Well, I did notice that there's a little bit of a connection to some other person that I dealt with a few years back. I don't know. Maybe. Could that be? Is that possible?
There was a little bit of...
I don't know.
In watching these 5 minutes in isolation, I did feel a little bit like sort of like... maybe McClane's detective skills are lacking a little bit in that there's a German guy targeting him. And he's like... What German guys do I know? It's like, you think it would have been the first thing he thought of, to be fair. It would have been like, well, I did have dealings, very memorable dealings with German people. It was not too long ago. So,
no, but I know that, you see, in that case, I actually don't think that John should be, you know, expected to know. No.
Yeah,
because, again, think about. He was in New York, then he was in Washington. You know, he's had so many cases over the last few years. You know, we're talking right now 7 years. Would you necessarily remember the voice of someone from 7 years before and make the connection? On the one hand, it could be a memorable night for him. You know, the fact that of what happened in Nakatomi, but he had the night in Dulles, which could sort of overshadow that in his memory.
Although I still think, though, like, how many, you know, like, if, as a cop, you know, 7 years ago, going from L.A. and then back to New York, like, presumably he's dealing with a lot of just American, you know, criminals. So then to be like, this guy has a German accent, it's going to be like, well, let me go through my Rolodex of people who I've dealt with, because he specifically asked for me. So it's like, he's targeting me in particular. Right. Who do I know who's German? Who have I dealt with in my past who's German? Oh, wait, there was that thing that happened. So now I think this might be a little bit of the symptom because of, obviously, this was adapted into a Die Hard film after the fact. I think maybe as the original Simon says, you know, it probably worked perfectly fine. But now it is a little bit egregious to be like, you know, as a good detective, I think John McClane should have been a bit like, well, you know, let me just go through quickly in my head. Who do I know who's German? Oh, wait, all that. Yeah, maybe it's got something to do with that, you know, prior to the scene. But obviously, then you wouldn't get a cool reveal like we do in a minute or two. So,
right, but I look at it from another perspective also. Like, I don't know what the original script was before it was a Die Hard movie. You know, like, what would have been the connection between Simon and whoever this main character is?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I'd be curious. You know? I'd be curious, because I'm assuming it just doesn't exist, the script. Like, it's not available anywhere. Like, it's not, no one's put it up.
I wasn't able to find it. I was only able to find a relatively early version of Simon Says.
Yeah.
You know, when it's John McClane. Mm. And that's what we use here.
Yeah. I would assume that maybe they didn't have a connector. It could have been just like, you know, they didn't feel like the need to, because it's only the real connective tissue to the first one is John McClane and the Grubers. It could be like they're like, well, we need to have something, so let's make him Hans's brother. And they just sort of added that in, you know, as they sort of like, oh, well, you know, a little bit of connective tissue there. Was maybe originally it was just like, nope, it's just totally, totally at random. You know, it's just like McClane or whoever the cop was in that version just got, you know, picked up the wrong phone or whatever. And all of a sudden now he's involved in all this. But yeah, but I guess we may never know. Hopefully, maybe with more digging, we might be able to find out at some point. But,
yeah. All right, so that's all I have for this minute. Do you have anything else for this minute before we get into the script?
Nothing for this minute.
All right, so the script deals a little bit in this minute. So it starts off with we hear Cobb calling out to John from off screen. McClane turns and looks. Cobb is outside the barricades, motioning to him. And then Cobb motions to Zeus, you two. McClane and Zeus get up and move past the barricades following Cobb. A dark van is parked in the alleyway down the street from the blast site. Two men in dark suits and sunglasses stand by the van. Their dress and demeanor indicates they are federal agents. McClane and Zeus follow Cobb to the van. One of the dark-suited men opens the door for them. Cobb climbs in. McClane and Zeus follow. McClane and Zeus get in and sit next to Cobb. In the back of the van is a bank of computers and phone modems manned by a young FBI agent. In the seat opposite are two men, 40s, staring at them. Andrew Cross and William Jarvis are deadly serious. Career G-Men. A briefcase sits on Jarvis's lap. Cross then says, Detective McClane, extends out his hand. Andrew Cross, Federal Bureau of Investigation. Nods to Zeus. Mr. Carver? McClane and Zeus shake Cross's hand. McClane turns to Jarvis. You also with the Bureau? Jarvis shakes his head, extending his hand. William Jarvis, Central Intelligence Administration. Call me Bill. The CIA and FBI? Why is the A-team here, Bill? The situation's worse than we thought, John. McClane says, that's saying a lot, considering the guy just blew up a subway. And that's all we'll get for this minute. I'll already say, the next 2 minutes, there's nothing in the in the script. It's completely, I guess, either ad-libbed or it was from a later version where they changed it. So, yeah. So every Monday, we have a segment called McTiernan Monday, where my guests will give their top five John McTiernan films. You don't have much to choose from.
But it's real slim pickings. So it's like, well, I put together with it's obviously, you know, I do feel you probably get a lot of people saying the same, the same variation almost really, but I did want to throw in. So going in reverse, all right. I would put in Nomads, which is his forgotten film immediately prior to Predator, which I discovered like a couple of years ago and was just like baffled to find out that this was a thing that like that existed, and like as you know, a lover of sort of bizarre horror films. Like that was this is the idea. It's like it's Pierce Brosnan as a French scientist getting pursued by Adam Ant, who and he's a part of a gang that might be demons or something. Like it was I thought it was great personally. Like it's terrible, but it's great, you know, in that way. So I'll fly the flag for Nomads. I don't know if many other people would, because it's
from what I recall, you were the first. Yes, you were the first.
Oh wow! So it's definitely slipped through the cracks of people so far. And then I would put Last Action Hero, which is a film I'm still waiting on the Renaissance for. Because, you know, eventually over time, people will grow to appreciate things that are, you know, that have been dumped on, you know, in their original run. So, like, obviously, like, even now, like, you like the 90s Super Mario Brothers movie has enough of a following where they recently did, like, a massive box set release for it and put, like, the, you know, brought out the special edition Blu-ray with, like, it came in this fancy, like, really intricately designed box and had all this kind of stuff, you know, falling out about it, but all the, you know, reams and reams of material of the making of the movie and stuff, because there's a market for it now. People, you know, not everybody, it's still regarded as a bad film. It's not a bad film, but, like, it's got enough of following now that over time that happens to a lot of things. Yet, The Last Action Hero is a movie I've loved my entire life, and I'm waiting for people to sort of finally come around to it, and still in the gutter, apparently, with people. Even though I think it's absolutely terrific. What's your opinion on The Last Action Hero?
I'm actually a big fan of it. Especially, you know, as a movie fan, you know, they do a great job of making fun of movies while showing their love for it, which is more or less what we do with MXN. You know, it's the same type of thing.
It's just like so many classic lines, so many classic jokes. It's just like Charles Dance's Benedict, just such a great villain. Just the whole and that whole thing of like the glass eye with the different glass eyes every time. And it's a fantastic film. Arnie's on fire in it too. Like he's really like it's the perfect blend of his action and comedy chops as well.
Yeah,
and it's like So I'm always waiting for eventually people will go like, you know what, The Last Action Hero was actually a really good film. It's like it always was, you know. But and then you know the top three is going to be obviously Predator. And then I think my top two will be in contention because it's both, you know, Die Hard and Die Hard with a Vengeance. But I would struggle to say which one's number one, which one's number two, because I genuinely think Die Hard with a Vengeance is as good as the first one. And some days, depending on the mood I'm in, I'll be like, I think it's better sometimes. But then you've literally got two perfect things, and you're going, well, which one's more perfect than the other? It's like it's a pretty tough call. But like, ask me if you see me, ask me on that day which one is better, and then I can give you the definitive one, number one.
And what's the answer for the definitive? What's the definitive answer for today, though?
Today, I would say Die Hard with a Vengeance because well, I'm not gonna. Potty mouth. I'm not going to decry the film we're talking about in a minute and hold up another one. But no, the minute I would say Die Hard with a Vengeance. Like it's just an amazing film. Love it so much. And I love everything about the fact too that like they learned the lesson from Die Hard too of like, okay, so I guess we got to get Al back in, and we gotta get the wife back in, and we get all the same formula back again. And then they just this one again, though, readapting it from a different script, I guess, probably helped a lot. But I just appreciate the fact that they're just like, nope, we've just created an entire new ream of great characters. So Charlie and Walter and Connie, all these people, they stand there on their own as well. It's like, oh, we didn't need to fall back on the old formula. Did a whole new thing, and then the dynamic with Zeus is like it's not like him and Powell. It's a completely different, different kind of way. But then these two guys
with completely
the chemistry of Bruce Willis and Samuel Jackson, like in the first 30 seconds, they're already like, oh, these guys, this is a coupling for the ages, you know, these two. So I think they did a fantastic job. Okay, I don't know if it'll be against the odds because he just had such a good a good foundation to start on, but like to go then afterwards like. Yeah, the last one didn't do it for a lot of people. So let's just go and do something completely another movie that's as good as the first one, I guess. So, put this at number one for the day at least.
Okay, excellent. All right, so Niall, you want to tell people where they can find you?
If you like hearing me talking about things in ridiculous amounts of detail, my main show is Bat Minutes, where we're going through the Batman films 1 minute at a time. And as of recording, just yesterday, me and my co-host on Batman and John are our side project, Miami Minutes, where we broke down and talked about every minute of the 1987 Taekwondo Craptacular Crest classic, Miami Connection. We just finished, just wrapped up there. So if anyone's been holding out, needs a binge, you've got a we got like 87 episodes of that just raring to go, just sitting there too. So both shows I'm very proud of, and I would encourage anyone to go and listen to any of them.
All right. Great. Excellent. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Move Around Minute. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter. You can find me on Instagram. And you can find me on my website, movearoundminute.com. And if you want to send me an email, you can send it to movearoundminute@movierob.net. So until tomorrow, yippee-ki-yay.
Yippee-ki-yay.
Marching home again. Hurrah. Hurrah. We'll give him a hearty welcome then. Hurrah. Hurrah! The men will cheer, the boys will shout, the ladies they will all turn out, and we'll all feel glad when Johnny comes marching home.